the murders of Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, Michael Brown Jr., Ayanna Jones, among many others, helped to galvanize African Americans across the country under the slogan, Black Lives Matter, then the acquittal of George Zimmerman, the refusal to indict the white officers demonstrate the resilience of the forces poised to coddle and protect the police. Like, what kind of society allows for its so-called law enforcement to prey on its population in the first place?
That's Kienga Yamata Taylor, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Kienga Yamata Taylor on Black Lives Matter. The Black Panther Party was founded 50 years ago. It did much to raise consciousness and pride among African Americans. It was seen as a threat by the establishment and was thus targeted by Hoover's FBI in a campaign of infiltration, destabilization, and assassination. Today, a new generation of activists has arisen in the aftermath of a series of outrageous killings of African Americans by police. The Black Lives Matter movement has reawakened attention to the historical and contemporary ravages of racism and the persistence of structural inequality, such as mass incarceration and unemployment. Who can forget Eric Garner's plea of "I can't breathe" before he was choked to death on a Staten Island street? It symbolizes the plight of many blacks trying to survive in crushing poverty. The Black Lives Matter movement holds the potential to reignite a broader push for black liberation. Our guest today is Kienga Yamata Taylor. She's an assistant professor in the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. Her articles appear in Counterpunch, International Socialist Review, and The Guardian. She's the author of Rats, Riots, and Revolution, and From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. She spoke in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And now, Kienga Yamata Taylor.
Black Lives Matter. Why is this happening now? Why did this movement erupt in the middle of the second term of the nation's first black president? The arrival of Black Lives Matter seemed simultaneously overdue and from out of nowhere. But if we think back towards the heady days of Barack Obama's election, as the nation's first black president, the New York Times ran a serious article that asked the question of whether the election meant the end of black politics. The idea was not that African Americans would no longer be involved in politics, but the assumption was that it would no longer be necessary for a separate and particular politics attuned to the oppression of black people. This, of course, dovetailed with the idea that the United States was entering into a post-racial period. And while most Americans didn't buy that the country was moving beyond race, among almost all Americans, there was widespread optimism that Obama's victory indicated that the country was shedding its long history of racial injustice. How ironic, then, during the twilight of Obama's presidency, we have witnessed the birth of a black social movement and the revival of radical black politics. The movement is known by its most popular slogan, Black Lives Matter. It is diffuse, angry, and has emerged in response to the continued plague of police murder, corruption, and violence throughout black America. Black Lives Matter is not incidental to the Obama presidency, but in many ways it is a product of it. And why did this happen, and why now did this happen now? Of equal importance, I think, in addition to trying to situate this movement and why it's happening now, I think it also raises the question of what does it mean for the prospects of actual black liberation in the United States? Certainly, the election of a black president in a country founded on native genocide and whose wealth was accumulated off of the enslaved labor of Africans is significant. But we also see that the Obama presidency has done very little to change the daily reality of most African Americans. Whether it is a Chicago police officer shooting 16 bullets at a black teenager, 14 of those bullets while he was in the fetal position on the ground, or whether it is the poisoning of the water in Flint, Michigan, a black majority city, Either of these, as we enter into the end of Obama's presidency, raise the question of whether or not African Americans can ever enjoy true freedom and self-determination. Self-determination meaning the ability to determine the direction of one's life, free of oppression, duress, or economic coercion. Can that ever be achieved in this country? That question is as relevant as it has ever been. But on the eve of Obama's first inauguration, 69% of African Americans said that King's dream had been fulfilled. There were high expectations from Black people that there would be a break with the politics of the past and that actual change was on the way. Obama's candidacy for president in 2007 did not begin with such high expectations, if people can recall. Black voters were skeptical about his viability as a candidate and his absence of civil rights credentials. Black voters put their chips on Hillary Clinton as a sure bet. And then Obama transformed his candidacy from the usual affair into something he and his supporters would go on to describe as a social movement. Obama tapped into the anger and exhaustion of ordinary Americans who were fed up with what seemed like endless war in the Middle East and Afghanistan, the complete incompetence of the federal government in reaction to Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, and the overall cynical nature of American politics with its idiotic sound bites and third grade level discourse. Recall how the soaring rhetoric of candidate Obama broke decisively with the status quo in American politics. Obama declared that we, ordinary people, were the change that we had been waiting for. Recall his impassioned pleas of yes, we can. When was the last time we heard a candidate running for the White House say, and I quote, "When we have faced down impossible odds, when we have been told we are not ready or that we shouldn't try or that we can't, generations of Americans have responded with a simple creed that sums up the spirit of a people. Yes, we can, yes, we can, yes, we can. It was whispered by slaves and abolitionists as they blazed a trail towards freedom through the darkest of nights. Yes, we can. It was sung by immigrants as they struck out from the distant shores and pioneers who pushed westward against an unforgiving wilderness. Yes, we can. It was the call of workers who organized, women who reached for the ballot, a president who chose the moon as our new frontier, and a king who took us to the mountaintop and pointed the way to the promised land. Yes, we can to justice and equality. Yes, we can to opportunity. Yes, we can heal this nation. Yes, we can repair this world. Yes, we can. So when people today defend the thin gruel of Obama's accomplishments by describing how awful the Republicans are, or that Obama's hands have been tied, and admonishments of, well, what did you expect? They forget how Obama himself raised all of these expectations in the first place. But for Black voters in particular, Obama's campaign represented even more than that. Not only because he was Black, and we shouldn't discount that in a racist country, but also because of what the Bush administration had represented. From the theft of the election in Florida in 2000, based on the disenfranchisement of Black voters, to again the shocking incompetence of the government response to Hurricane Katrina, Black voters turned out for Obama like never before. Young Black voters produced the highest proportional voter turnout in the nation's history. For the first time, a higher percentage of eligible Black voters supplanted the white electorate. But almost as quickly as Obama became president, so too did the disillusionment with his limitations. It was not all at once, but there were three significant markers for African Americans that pointed to continuity with the past and not the change that had been promised. The first factor was Obama's benign response to the economic crisis in Black communities. As most will know that by the end of 2008, the American economy was in free fall. African Americans would bear the brunt of the Great Recession and economic crisis that would ensue. By the end, more than 240,000 Black homeowners would lose their houses. By the fall of 2009, Black unemployment had reached a high of 15%, fueled by cuts to federal and state government jobs that had always been a bedrock for black employment. Walmart would become the largest employer of black Americans, taking over the historic role of work in the U.S. Postal Service. The net worth of black families fell to $11,000 compared to $141,000 for whites. And a whopping 40% of black families had zero or negative wealth. Black child poverty reached 40% in 2012, and the list could go on and on. It appeared that a black president was coming onto the scene right on time. Who better to understand how racial discrimination and inequality would create uneven access to the programs intended to accelerate the economic recovery? In particular, and even yes, special provisions would have to be made to pull African Americans out of the worst economic crisis since the Depression. But Obama preached that there was nothing in particular he could do for the growing numbers of the black poor, the black unemployed, or black homeowners. He said, in a sense, a rising tide would lift all boats. The second factor was how the president characterized black poverty. Obama was reluctant to offer particular assistance to African Americans, but he did not show the same reticence when it came to invoking the stale yet highly effective stereotypes of African Americans as somehow being responsible for their own predicament. It was stunning. While the entire Western world was blaming Wall Street for its reckless practices, while everyone began to turn their attention to the economic inequality of capitalism and all of the structural problems of the economy, Barack Obama scolded black parents for feeding their kids cold fried chicken, for watching television instead of reading books, and indeed lectured black America that there were, quote, no excuses for any predicament that they might find themselves in. Without question, some, if not many, African Americans agreed with the criticism of the black poor and working class. It fit the common sense of the last 40 years that black people suffer these disparities because of a lack of personal responsibility. It's an argument that has been reinforced at every level of government, in the mass media, and in our popular culture. And yet for others, it was an argument that completely contradicted their experience. Black homeowners had played by the rules and were cashing in on the American dream, but they were bilked by mortgage lenders and dirty banking practices, and in turn were left penniless. Black college graduates who had played by the rules also were still three times as likely to be unemployed as their white counterparts. Black men with no criminal record at all and looking for work were as likely to be called back for work as white men with a criminal record. So discrimination and other objective factors that had nothing to do with morality or responsibility in black communities were the culprits behind black poverty. And this was affirmed by the explosion of the Occupy movement in the fall of 2011. Occupy forced the growing problems of poverty and inequality into the center of American politics by popularizing the slogan, "We are the 99%. As opposed to the wealthiest 1% of the population that controls the vast majority of wealth and resources in our country. Occupy was often described as a white movement, but polls found that 45% of African Americans expressed a positive view of Occupy, and an additional 35% said the movement was good for the American political system. This would put many African Americans directly at odds with the no excuses mantra the president often repeated for black audiences. Finally, the growing excesses and brutality of the American criminal justice system, from violent policing to mass incarceration and beyond, drew attention to how much things remain the same. The moments that Obama had to affirm black concerns with what people were referring to as a criminal injustice system were systematically ignored. For example, in September of 2011, an international campaign was underway to save the life of a wrongfully convicted black death row inmate named Troy Davis. Everyone from the Pope to the European Union to the governments of France and Germany, and even the former director of the FBI campaigned to save Davis's life. The night that Davis was to be executed, hundreds of black college students across Washington, D.C. marched and rallied at the Supreme Court and at the White House, hoping to lure Obama out of the White House to intervene in some way or other in order to save Davis's life. But Obama did nothing. He never even made a statement, instead opting to send his spokesperson out to the press to insist that this was a states' rights issue. For many, this was exactly the reason he had been elected, to intervene in moments like this. But instead, it was more of the same and very little change. The murder of Trayvon Martin and the subsequent acquittal of George Zimmerman marked a clear rupture with the Obama administration. As the slow trickle of facts concerning the death of Martin began to come to light, it was clear that he had been the victim of an extralegal killing. Meanwhile, Florida officials coddled and protected George Zimmerman from being arrested for the death of Martin. With the spirit of militant protest having been aroused the previous fall by the Troy Davis demonstrations and the explosion of the Occupy Wall Street movement, marches, demonstrations, sit-ins, and occupations had been validated. Black and white activists who had been involved in Occupy connected with the new people drawn into the streets by the horror of the Martin murder. As the protests swelled, Obama was finally forced to speak publicly. But in doing so, he only spoke personally, saying that if he had a son, he might look like Trayvon. Considered poignant by the media, it failed to articulate or resonate with growing black anger against police misconduct in Florida and the refusal of officials to arrest Martin's killer. Eventually, Zimmerman would be arrested, tried, and ultimately acquitted as Trayvon Martin was transformed from a 17-year-old boy walking home to his father's house to a marijuana-smoking, oversized thug who was the actual aggressor. When the verdict was announced, Obama implored the public to respect the jury's decision, claiming, quote, "We are a nation of laws." What did this even mean when the Martin case so clearly demonstrated that we are a nation with two sets of laws, one for African Americans and one for everyone else? Everyone understood that if the tables had been turned, if Martin had violently set upon and shot and killed George Zimmerman, he would have been arrested immediately and ultimately convicted. The raised expectations of African Americans with the Obama presidency had been dashed over and over again. In the aftermath of the Zimmerman verdict, Alicia Garza, a labor organizer in the Bay Area, created the hashtag Black Lives Matter. Its declarative simplicity articulated the anger of a generation, and the pieces of a movement begin to take shape. Why the issue of police brutality? Police violence against black people is not new. In 1951, a multiracial contingent of activists in the Civil Rights Congress raised the slogan, "We Charge Genocide," to characterize the depth and consequences of police murder and the silent complicity of the state. The preamble of their petition read, in part, quote, "There was a time when racist violence had its center in the South. Once most of the violence against Negroes occurred in the countryside, but that was before the Negro immigrations of the 20s and 30s. Now there is not a great American city from New York to Cleveland or Detroit, from Washington, the nation's capital, to Chicago, from Memphis to Atlanta or Birmingham, from New Orleans to Los Angeles, that is not disgraced by the wanton killing of innocent Negroes. It is no longer a sectional phenomenon. Once the classic method of lynching was the rope, now it is the policeman's bullet. To many an American, the police are the government, certainly its most visible representative. We submit that the evidence suggests that the killing of Negroes has become police policy in the United States, and that police policy is the most practical expression of government policy." 1951. Today, there is no shortage of issues that black people in this country could mobilize around. But police brutality remains the catalyst for black protest because it is the clearest example of the compromised citizenship of black people. When the police can approach you, search you, arrest you, and even kill you with impunity, it means that you don't have first-class citizenship, you have second-class citizenship. And the part of this that radicalizes black people is how this second-class citizenship stands in such sharp conflict with what the United States says about itself. We as a nation, including black people, are always told that this is the greatest country on earth. We believe in American exceptionalism and the promises of unfettered opportunity for anyone willing to work for it. We believe in the American dream. And so last year, when Obama was explaining a new war front against ISIS, he said, "America, our endless blessings bestow an enduring burden. But as Americans, we welcome our responsibility to lead. From Europe to Asia, from the far reaches of Africa to war-torn capitals of the Middle East, we stand for freedom, for justice, for dignity. These are values that have guided our nation since its founding. Freedom, justice, and dignity. What do those words mean to the family of Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old that was shot and killed by police within 1.6 seconds of arriving on the scene? What does it mean when the cops who killed him will not face charges? What does it mean to Ayanna Jones, a 7-year-old girl sleeping on a couch in her house in Detroit, who was killed by police in a botched raid? What does it mean that those officers will not be punished? If you don't know these cases and hundreds of others like them, then look them up. Find out what is happening in this country. Because these blustering statements about how wonderful America is when black people are getting mowed down in the streets is completely and utterly absurd. That's right. The perception of the greatness of America also is why it is difficult to get the legal means and institutions to address this issue of police terrorism. The United States' authority to dictate, police, and moralize to the rest of the world stems from its apparent role as the self-described greatest democracy on earth. But the entire history and contemporary lives of black people confound and upend this notion. What would it uncover and reveal about the United States to acknowledge that a police state exists in most working class and poor black neighborhoods, where the police are empowered to do absolutely anything they want? The state has taken the position that ignorance is bliss. And if you think this is an exaggeration, then consider this. The Guardian newspaper ran a story last year on the inconsistent ways the federal government tracks the number of people killed annually by law enforcement. This is a generous way of saying that while the government can tell you how many children die of the flu each week, and they can tell you how many eggs a hen lays each month, and they can even tell you what percentage of white men over the age of 20 consume nuts as snacks, they cannot tell you how many people die at the hands of law enforcement in a given week, month, or year. They cannot tell you the race or ethnicity of those who are killed by law enforcement. And when you look at the numbers that have been called together, you understand why. According to the findings of a study conducted by the Bureau of Justice Statistics on police homicides, in the years 2003 to 2009 and 2011, so excluding 2010, American police killed 7,427 people. That's an average of 928 people a year. And since the government won't count, the Guardian newspaper took it upon itself over the last year, 2015, to count those killed by the police. And they counted 1,134 people killed by American law enforcement last year. And so if you add these numbers up from the study and include 2012, 2013, and 14, applying those averages, and include 2015, we are talking about over 11,000 people killed by American police since 2003. Consider that 58 American soldiers were killed in Iraq last year, or that 78 people were killed by law enforcement in Canada in 2014, or that from 2010 to 2014, police in England killed 4 people. In Germany, the police killed no one in 2013 and 2014. In China, with a population 4.5 times the size of the United States, they recorded 12 police killings in 2014. And this is only a fraction of what we know. There are 18,000 police departments in the United States, and only 1,000 of them bother to report to the federal government how many people they kill each year. The New York City Police Department, for example, has not reported on how many civilians it has killed since 2007. The state of Florida does not report at all. So we have a very limited view of the extent of police homicide in the United States. And because of the lack of consistent tracking, we have no idea what proportion of these deaths are incurred by African Americans or Latinos. But we do know that African Americans endure the disproportionate encounters with police, and thus we can assume that the vast majority of those killed are black or brown. If this were happening in any other country, it would be called what it is, an abject abuse of any notion of human or civil rights, bearing all the markings of an authoritarian police state where murder and mayhem at the hands of the state is boiled down to the cost of doing business. And the cost of doing business is quite high. In the city of Chicago alone, the city spent $500 million over the last 10 years to settle or pay out lawsuits against the city for police brutality and wrongful deaths attributed to the police. The New York City Police Department has averaged $100 million settlements for police brutality and wrongful death lawsuits a year over the last decade, adding up to $1 billion. In any other public institution that incurred this kind of expense of deficit would have its budget cut and its services shrank, or the institution altogether would be shut down. When the Chicago Board of Education claimed it was running a billion-dollar deficit in 2013 or 2012, they simply closed 52 public schools and never looked back. But no one ever suggests closing police departments, police precincts. The police in the United States have always been an oppressive institution, but these practices have become worse and more widespread recently. The police, more recently, have been deployed to handle the consequences of the steady attrition of an already weak American welfare state. When you cut funding to public schools, public hospitals, and mental health clinics, when you cut welfare, housing assistance, and food stamps, you are essentially making the severity of the economic crisis even harsher. The disinvestment in the public sector and the multiple programs intended to mitigate poverty has cities with little alternative except to push poor and working class people out. Policing has become the public policy of last resort. So for example, in the section of Baltimore where young Freddie Gray, whose death ignited the Baltimore Rebellion last April, the section of Baltimore where he was pursued, picked up, and eventually had his neck almost completely severed by police, was one of the poorest neighborhoods in the entire city. 21% were unemployed. 25% of the buildings were abandoned. The life expectancy in Freddie Gray's neighborhood was 6 years shorter than the rest of the city. 55% of the families in that neighborhood were living on less than $25,000 a year. 3 weeks before Gray was killed, police were instructed to increase their presence and to increase the number of arrests on the actual corner that Freddie Gray was picked up on. The police have been inserted where the rest of the state has failed. And policing has also become politicized in the sense that local elections and politicians have created political value out of rising arrest rates and falling crime rates by aggressively tracking police statistics and turning them into campaign fodder, which also incentivizes aggressive policing. Finally, when revenue streams are tight in cities and raising taxes is akin to political suicide, law enforcement has become a de facto way for municipalities to raise funds on the backs of the politically weak and vulnerable. Part of what ignited the rebellion in Ferguson in August of 2014 was that the city had become dependent on ticketing and fining black residents so much so that it had become the second leading source of revenue in the city. In 2014, the year of the Ferguson uprising, 33,000 minor arrest warrants were issued, mostly for delinquent traffic violations, to a population of only 21,000 people. New York City profited from $10 million a week in parking tickets. The city made almost $1 billion a year in court and administrative fines and fees. These, of course, create incentives for the police to target people and entire neighborhoods as sources of income for the city. And encounters with the police of this nature, of course, then envelop people into the criminal justice system, thereby making it even harder to get a job or maintain any level of economic stability.
You're listening to Kianga Yamata Taylor on Black Lives Matter. This is Alternative Radio, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Black people are disproportionately poor in the United States. There are 45 million people who are officially designated as poor, and African Americans are 27% of the total. It means that the police are more likely to be deployed into black neighborhoods. The police, as an institution, have then fully absorbed racial stereotypes as it pertains to African Americans because of their over-deployment in black neighborhoods. There is really no other way to understand the casual disregard for black life in the hands of police. Consider how Michael Slager, the officer in South Carolina, who calmly took aim as if he were conducting target practice when he shot a fleeing Walter Scott 8 times in the back. Recall Tamir Rice again, who was not only shot by these officers within 2 seconds, 1.6 seconds of arriving, but how he lay unattended, dying, as the two officers stood passively by, refusing to help him. This is the context within which this new movement has erupted. Elected officials have not brought these truths to life or to light, and neither have the institutions charged with protecting the welfare of the public. Within a span of 9 months, black protest and rebellion in the town of Ferguson and the city of Baltimore thrust the crisis of police murder right into the center of American politics. While news observers and elected officials could cynically dismiss Ferguson as the town that progress forgot, with its black majority population cruelly governed by a white governing structure, no such excuses could be made about Baltimore. Not only does Baltimore have a black mayor, police chief, state's attorney, half the city council is black, the head of the superintendent of the schools is black, so on and so forth, but more generally, we are witnessing the greatest concentration of black political power in the nation's history. Today, there is a black president, black attorney general, not to mention the thousands of black elected officials in cities and states around the country. There are 43 black members of Congress, the highest number in American history. It is clear that a layer of blacks have been fully absorbed and integrated into American capitalism, and they, like the president, can be the most vociferous when denouncing poor and working class African Americans. Black Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, she's the mayor of Baltimore. At one point prior to the rebellion in Baltimore, in March, the rebellion was in April, said, quote, "Too many of us in the black community have become complacent about black on black crime. While many of us are willing to march and protest and become active in the face of police misconduct, many of us turn a blind eye when it's killing us. Of course, she and Obama both referred to young blacks in the rebellion as thugs and criminals, two words that were never used by the white officials of Ferguson. In other words, often black elected officials help to narrate the experience of African Americans in ways that white elected officials could never get away with, by blaming blacks through rhetoric that emphasizes culture, immorality, and irresponsibility as the source of black inequality, as opposed to racism and economic inequality. This deepening chasm between the black elite and the black working class has made the question of class solidarity in the movement an important one. Historically, the black movement has always cut across class lines because of the all-encompassing nature of American racism. But as more black elected officials are governing the cities and suburbs where black workers live, it has created a deeper antagonism that frays the notion of solidarity, of an unspoken solidarity between all blacks. When the black mayor of Baltimore mobilizes the military to occupy the black neighborhoods while allowing whites to come and go freely and ignore an imposed martial law that has turned into martial law for blacks, the idea that we are all on the same side and in the same struggle deteriorates. Black people want to be free, but we cannot get free alone. No one knows what will come of this new political development, but many know the causes of its gestation. For as much success as some African Americans have achieved, 4 million black children live in poverty. 1 million black people are incarcerated. 240,000 black people lost their homes, resulting in the loss of hundreds of millions of dollars in black savings. Never before in American history has a black president presided over the misery of millions of black people, the denial of the most basic standards for health, happiness, and humanity. Entertainer and activist Harry Belafonte recalled his last conversation with Martin Luther King, in which King lamented, quote, "I've come upon something that disturbs me deeply. We fought hard and long for integration, as I believe we should have, and I know that we will win. But I've come to believe we're integrating into a burning house." The aspiration for black liberation cannot be separated from what happens in the United States as a whole. Black life cannot be transformed while the rest of the country burns. The fires consuming the United States are stoked by the widespread alienation of low-wage and meaningless work, unaffordable rents, suffocating debt and poverty. The essence of economic inequality is borne out in a simple fact. There are 400 billionaires in the United States and 45 million people living in poverty. These are not parallel facts, they are intersecting facts. There are 400 American billionaires because there are 45 million people living in poverty. Profit comes at the expense of the living wage. Corporate executives and capitalists in general are living the good life because so many others are living a life of hardship. The struggle for black liberation, then, is not an abstract idea molded in isolation from the wider phenomenon of economic exploitation and inequality that pervade all of American society. It is intimately bound up with them. But the continuing racial divide in American society over perceptions of police Do not present ordinary white working class people as a natural ally to blacks in the struggle against the police. Of course, some of this is changing because of the movement. Today, compared to a year ago, attitudes across the board regarding police in the U.S. are changing. Last January, 56% of whites believed that the reported cases of police brutality were isolated incidents. Today, only 36% believe them to be isolated. There is much more to be done, but the growing net of policing also affects white people. American police are more prone to kill young black men, but they have also killed thousands of white men over the last 10 years. This is an objective basis upon which to build solidarity between ordinary blacks and ordinary white people. But it's not just solidarity with the white working class that is in question. In general, the movement has to grow. It has to go beyond blacks who are most affected. It has to draw in other parts of the working class that also suffer under police racism and attack, including Latinos, Arabs, Muslims, undocumented workers, trans people, so on and so forth. There also has to be a concerted effort to draw in organized labor, which has a disproportionately higher level of representation among black workers, into the movement. We can imagine a future of workplace actions against police brutality and murder, where working people refuse to work until corrupt cops have been fired or arrested. But that has to be organized. It has to be argued for. The movement has to connect with the existing struggles against injustice and inequality, like in education, where black students, teachers, and parents continue to fight for the future of public education. The movement must connect with the black student movement on campuses as a way to broaden its forces. The movement has to connect with the low-wage struggle for a higher minimum wage and the right to collectively bargain over benefits. In short, the movement must grow to develop and cohere the forces actually capable of stopping police terror and all of the problems connected to it: racism, poverty, and inequality. Because if the murders of Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, Michael Brown Jr., Ayanna Jones, among many others, help to galvanize African Americans across the country under the slogan "Black Lives Matter," then the acquittal of George Zimmerman, the refusal to indict the white officers in the deaths of Eric Garner, Mike Brown, and most recently Tamir Rice, the decision to grant bail and release Michael Slager, who shot Walter Scott, the decision of a San Francisco judge to reinstate police officers who exchanged texts that declared white power and, among other things, quote, "All niggers must hang. Niggers should be spayed. I just saw one with four kids." Then these cases demonstrate the resilience of the forces poised to coddle and protect the police. We must end this culture of police violence and racism, but we must also recognize that it will produce larger questions, like what kind of society allows for its so-called law enforcement to prey on its population in the first place. Last year was the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War, and with it, the first declaration of civil rights for African Americans. This year, we continue to celebrate the 50th anniversaries of the civil rights movement from the decade of the 1960s. 150 years is long enough to wait for black freedom. This is not a reason for despair, however, but a reason to clarify what it is that we are fighting for. The political status quo would love to narrow and shoehorn our struggle into one for body cameras on the police or greater diversity of police forces. But the slogan of black liberation raises the greater question of how black people can become genuinely free. And that requires looking beyond the existing society that has racial inequality and racial injustice so tightly wound into the marrow of its bones that there is literally no period of time in this country's existence where black oppression was not a key feature. Is racist, unequal, discriminatory, capitalist society, is this society the best that we can do as a species? The black movement in this country has never been only about black people. As people in the movement say, when black people get free, everyone gets free. And so, I want to end with a quote from Martin Luther King that exemplifies, I think, and really explains the centrality and importance of the black struggle in all of American politics. This was an article that he wrote in the days after the Detroit Rebellion in 1967, but I think it is just as relevant today. He wrote, quote, "I am not sad that black Americans are rebelling. This was not only inevitable, but eminently desirable. Without this magnificent ferment among Negroes, the old evasions and procrastinations would have continued indefinitely. Black men have slammed the door shut on a past of deadening passivity. Except for the Reconstruction years, they have never in their long history on American soil struggled with such creativity and courage for their freedom. These are our bright years of emergence. Though they are painful ones, they cannot be avoided. In these trying circumstances, the Black Revolution is more than a struggle for the rights of Negroes. It is forcing America to face all of its interrelated flaws: racism, poverty, militarism, and materialism. It is exposing the evils that are rooted deeply in the whole structure of our society. It reveals systemic rather than superficial flaws and suggests that radical reconstruction of society itself is the real issue to be faced. Today's dissenters tell the complacent majority that the time has come when further evasion of social responsibility in a turbulent world will court disaster and death. America has not changed because so many people think it need not change. But this is the illusion of the damned. America must change because 23 million black citizens will no longer live supinely in a wretched past. They have left the valley of despair. They have found strength in struggle. Joined by white allies, they will shake the prison walls until they fall. America must change. Thank you. You know, and rebellions are in some ways this kind of spontaneous uprisings, revolt against what people perceive to be an injustice. But at the same time, you have a proliferation of different types of organizing that is filtering throughout American society. So you have the formation of student organizations, you have the formation of labor organizations, groups like the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, but many sort of radical working class organizations throughout different sectors of labor. And so there are countless examples I think you can point to in the 1960s that give you some sense of what it looks like when there's a kind of political awakening and people begin to understand the centrality of organizing beyond just protest. And so I think in some ways we've seen some type of that most recently. So from the rebellions in Ferguson to Baltimore on the one hand, but a proliferation of organizations that have formed to organize, I think, in a more sustained way around police violence. So there's Black Lives Matter, the hashtag, the group, because there's, you know, people refer to the general movement as Black Lives Matter, but there's an actual organization, Hands Up United, which is an organization out of Ferguson, Black Youth Project. I mean, there's a number of groups that have developed. And then I think locally, there are even many other kinds of organizations that we don't even know about. I mean, I was looking online yesterday, and there was an article about the new civil rights movement in Cincinnati. Well, who knew, you know? I think what is important about that is that sometimes we can get hung up on what the most sort of known or popular groups are doing or not doing and make assumptions about the entire health of the movement based on that. And what I think Baltimore and Ferguson did was open up the possibility for anyone to get active and for anyone to get involved in this. And so there's a whole number of groups and organizing on a local level to take on these things, which I think is really important. On a basic math level, Black people are 12% of the population here, and so in the United States. So the idea that you can have a Black-only movement into perpetuity, or that Black people can get free alone, doesn't compute. And so it means that solidarity becomes critical, but I also think that the way that we conceive of solidarity has to move beyond this kind of idea of allyship, that people should get involved in your struggle for altruistic reasons or because they feel bad for you or they feel sorry for you. But we have to understand how our fates are tied together. I mean, it means the popularization of the notion that there is a 99% and a 1% is incredibly important because it helps to illustrate the objective basis, I think, that we can argue for building that type of solidarity. So one of the things I talk about is, what do we do with white people? Because, you know, people always, you know, what will happen with white people? And it's like, we have to take that question seriously. There are 20 million poor white people in this country. And so to only have a notion of white supremacy as the only framework for understanding that can't tell us how we understand that there are 20 million poor white people in this country. And it doesn't mean that you subsume the issues of racism to make an appeal to these people. It means that you have to convince them how racism is not only destructive for Black people, but it's destructive for white people too. So that if the Republicans use racism as a way of attacking food stamps, for example, yes, that has a horrible impact on Black people, but it's white people who make up the majority of people who are food stamps recipients. So it has an impact on white people too. And so I think that we have to get concrete about what Black freedom and how to achieve that will look like, and that involves dealing with this question of ordinary white people. I think it involves reaching out to the undocumented, to the immigrant populations in this country, whether they're Latino, whether they're Muslims. They're basically, our government, you know, has helped to kind of forge this kind of coalition through attacking everyone. And so, you know, as activists, we have to try to make those links and see how organic they are and not just ask people to come and be involved in our movements for struggle on an altruistic basis. And I think that is part of how we open up the larger discussion about not just ending police violence and police terrorism, which is, you know, an important confining, has a that kind of impact in Black people and other people's lives, but it opens up the broader question about what kind of society are we living in and how can we get to a different one that doesn't rely on police to contain the problems and crises that are the product of this maldistribution of wealth and resources in this country.
That was Kianga Yamata Taylor on Black Lives Matter. She spoke in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Kianga Yamata Taylor is assistant professor in the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. She's the author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. We offer our weekly program free of charge to all public and community radio stations in the United States, Canada, Australia, and beyond. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Michelle Alexander, Bobby Seale, Richard Wolff, Angela Davis, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Chris Hedges, Vandana Shiva, and Noam Chomsky. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of today's program, Kianga Yamata Taylor on Black Lives Matter, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Barbara Ventrello and the Lannan Foundation. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.